At this most historic of inaugurations, they're selling like hotcakes.
Keys, humidifiers, heaters, weather stripping, flags, hand warmers, foot warmers, hats, gloves, earmuffs, and air mattresses.
That's right, keeping out the cold to better usher in the new administration. Inauguration revelers storm Washington, D.C. hardware stores to brave the winds out of the north. Will the new president wear a hat? It's not just a fashion statement this time. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 19th, and I'm over here scratching my head. Air mattresses?
Yeah, well, they want to sit down, be comfortable, not sit on the cold concrete, probably along the parade route.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds good.
It's freezing down there in Washington. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. The pomp and circumstance and the lead up to the inauguration of the country's first African-American president. We'll have more on that. Also, the ins and outs of the Israel-Gaza ceasefire. And Abu Dhabi is thinking green. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
Inauguration festivities in Washington are underway. Things got rolling with a concert at the Lincoln Memorial yesterday. President-elect Barack Obama told the hundreds of thousands on the Mall that the historic monuments weren't the only thing setting the tone for this inauguration.
It is you, Americans of every race and region and station, who came here because you believe in what this country can be and because you want to help us get there.
President-elect is marking Martin Luther King Day by helping out as a volunteer. He's asked all citizens to celebrate the holiday as a day of service.
U.S. Airways pilot Chelsea Sullenberger has been invited to the inauguration. He made last week's emergency landing on the Hudson River. Most of the jetliner now is on a barge docked in New Jersey. The remaining engine will come out as soon as weather conditions allow. And overseas, Israel is pulling its troops out of Gaza. Hamas has declared a week-long ceasefire, but Hamas spokesman Abu Hamza says the group has not changed its position.
They don't have any clear aim. So they attacked everything here. They are bloodthirsty.
This morning, the Saudi king, King Abdullah, says his country will donate $1 billion for the reconstruction of Gaza.
The Pittsburgh Steelers are headed to the Super Bowl. They beat the Baltimore Ravens last night to take the AFC championship, and they clinched it in the final moments.
He waits. He throws the pass, and it's intercepted. John Polamalu at the 40, 35, 30. Blockers at the 25. He's running right at the 15. He turns and goes for the goal line.
Yeah. In the NFC, the Arizona Cardinals beat the Philadelphia Eagles. It's the Cardinals' first visit to the Super Bowl. Wall Street is closed for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Oil's around $36 a barrel in Asian trading. So if Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, what would he organize millions to march for or against?
Discrimination against immigrants might be his center focus.
We're thinking about the mountaintop that Dr. King talked about when he was alive. What do you think his fight would be in 2009? What would he see from the top of that mountain? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. A lot of people will be thinking about that mountaintop
in
Washington.
No question. And what do you tell your kids about Martin Luther King's legacy? What does it mean to them today in 2009? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In Gaza, the tanks are rolling. But the Israeli military personnel are on their way out of the Gaza Strip. Over the weekend, Israel declared a unilateral ceasefire in its 3-week-old offensive in the Gaza Strip. And Hamas matched it this morning with a week-long ceasefire of its own. Two unilateral ceasefires. Are they related? Well, they are related by timing, in any case, at this point. And, of course, the timing is interesting because Israel ended its offensive well in advance of the Barack Obama inauguration, as was predicted by many observers in the region. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Charles Levinson. He's Wall Street Journal Jerusalem Bureau Chief. He joins us from Gaza, where he's in the territory, sitting at a restaurant this afternoon. Charles, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What is the sense of what Israel achieved among the people in Gaza that you talked to, if anything?
Well, I mean, the Palestinians, I mean, are definitely seeing this as a victory for Hamas, or at least certainly Hamas is portraying it that way, and certainly a lot of people are echoing that sentiment. They point to the fact that Hamas, this, you know, somewhat ragtag militia compared to the mighty Israeli army, simply survived the onslaught. There was also, you know, giving quite inflated. There's a lot of credibility here given among the Palestinians in Gaza to Hamas's sort of inflated number of Israeli casualties. They're saying they killed 80 Israelis, even though Israel says only 13 Israelis died in the war. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a sense here that this is going to be spun, at least on this side of the border, as a victory for Hamas.
Well, with the spin aside, though, is there a sense of weariness in Gaza that Hamas maybe overplayed their hand, was not expecting such a severe response, and that now they're going to need $1 billion from the Saudis, at least, to even begin a reconstruction of the 20,000 buildings that have been damaged?
I mean, that's certainly what the Israelis hope, that by, you know, launching this sort of destructive campaign, they can drive a wedge between the population and Hamas. Certainly that's not playing out anecdotally here, and history doesn't really suggest that's the case either. Certainly, you know, what happened to Hezbollah in 2006 didn't weaken Hezbollah. I think it only strengthened the movement. And you can go back, you know, decades and see how, you know, these sort of operations don't actually separate the people from the whatever resistance group is they're trying to be separated from, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas or the Palestinian Liberation Organization in the past, that rather, you know, these drive people into the arms of Hamas, that suddenly they see Hamas as the people who are defending their rights, or Hezbollah as the people that are defending their rights.
Well, Charles, let's look at how we would measure that. I mean, certainly the sense of rearming Hamas from the southern border with Egypt is one detail that Israel has talked about as a way of understanding if Hamas has actually been limited by this military offensive. But if we're to look at the Lebanon example, Hezbollah, how did they portray their success, and might Hamas try to do something that would echo the Hezbollah victory?
Well, of course, one of the first things, parallels between the two is Hezbollah succeeded, you know, up until the very last day of the war. Hezbollah was still firing, you know, dozens and dozens of rockets at Israel every day. Hamas didn't succeed like Hezbollah succeeded in that, you know, the number of rockets they were able to fire at Israel decreased quite significantly over the course of the war. But again, for the sake of the information campaign, they did continue firing rockets up until the last day. And indeed, after Israel declared a ceasefire, they still fired off another salvo. So, you know, they will point to that and say, you know, look, they didn't stop us from firing the rockets as Israel declared. So that's one sort of parallel between the two.
What about rearming through the Egyptian border zone?
Well, that's, you know, that remains to be seen whether they're able to or not, and, you know, how, if they're not able to, how does that affect their standing, their popularity here? You know, it's a big question. It remains to be seen. I mean, the assumption is that if they succeed, well, first of all, stopping the tunnels is really difficult. But if they should succeed in stopping the tunnels, then that'll have to be. In return for some sort of freeing up of the borders, because if you don't have the tunnels or the border crossings, then nothing can get in or out of this territory.
Which is why this ceasefire is fragile and why the clock is ticking. And as the Barack Obama administration takes over, inaugurated tomorrow, there's going to be a real instantaneous shift from the Bush administration's diplomatic efforts to the Obama administration's diplomatic efforts. Charles Levinson, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Charles Levinson is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, joining us from Gaza, where there are two unilateral ceasefires, and the fighting has stopped for now.
And John mentioned the inauguration of Barack Obama, and on an entirely different note, the story coming up is about what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. It's just buzzing with all of the energy of millions of Americans who have made their way there for tomorrow's inauguration. And our The Takeaways, Eyes and Ears, is our own Femi Okeh. She's in the middle of it all. Good morning, Femi, and what's happening?
Hello there, Adora. With an estimated up to 5 million people going to be here in DC, my assignment was very simple, just to find out some of their stories, to sample the atmosphere and bring it to our listeners on The Takeaway. So last night I arrived in DC very late, got straight off the plane and went straight to Party Central, which is basically Adams Morgan neighbourhood. It's here that the opening hours for the bars are extended to 4 a.m. So it's basically one big street party.
Well, they're usually now, open until 3. I used to live there, so it's not that big of a deal.
They tried to get it to 5, but the locals actually complained about it. So it's up to 4 a.m. now, so an extra hour to drink and be out there in the clubs and nightclubbing. And it's a very diverse neighborhood as well, so people are heading to that general neighborhood in order just to get a feel for the vibe and the celebratory mood, basically, in D.C. So I met up with Tamia, Jennifer and Ebony. And the way I found them was they were just discussing what they had to do in the next couple of days. And Tamika Webster, who is from Anchorage, Alaska, she told me that she went to the Lincoln Memorial concert and gave me an instant review. She was expecting to love Mary J. Blige. She couldn't wait to see Beyonce. But she was really shocked and came away fans of a particular artist.
Garth Brooks. Put on the best damn show.
Shout a little bit louder now, a little bit softer now.
Garth Brooks put on the show. I now want to go to a Garth Brooks concert.
Garth Brooks, crossover artist.
It is so infectious, just that their excitement.
And that was really what Garth Brooks did on stage yesterday afternoon. The whole crowd got going. So from Lincoln Memorial back to the Washington Memorial and then further back there, maybe over 400,000 people all got dancing to Garth Brooks. He really worked the crowd.
For free. So that was one also, for free.
For free, you see. And this was one of the free events happening. There's a neighborhood ball happening in the next couple of days. Tonight, Aretha Franklin will pay for free if you line up outside of the Kennedy Center at 4 p.m. this afternoon. One by one, tickets will be given out for free. Ebony Patrice Laurel is an economic financial analyst. She was in Adams Morgan's neighborhood last night. She works for Wells Fargo. And when it comes to entertainment, she was determined to shop around for some bargains.
We're trying to get into free places. Free. Yes, because it is a recession.
$10.
Yes, we're not trying to go into the $10 spots, anything that's free.
That's
so no love, because love is $50.
Love is only $50? That's a good thing I learned that here on The Takeaway. No, but seriously, there are a number of free events all week there in D.C., right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, what's the city is changing today. There's a different atmosphere today. Of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. D.C., like many other areas around the United States, actually acknowledging a call to service. So lots of events about giving service, giving back to the community. It's a bit of a breather for the D.C. area, because around that central area, pedestrians are just going to be able to get into the area. Cars are going to be kept out of that region. Many buses turning up as well. There's also a worry from some people coming into the area that it actually may be too crowded. Temperatures right now around about 35 degrees.
Ooh, chilly.
So it is very cold. Yeah, very cold, and expected to actually get colder on Tuesday.
Now, when you're talking about the pedestrian area, you mean just the mall area, right? Between the two monuments
around
and the
mall
Capitol.
Area.
Right, okay.
So about 5 or 6 blocks back in either direction, you'll only be able to get into that area on foot, and that really happens in the next couple of hours, and it will be sealed off right towards the end of the swearing-in ceremony and the end of the parade. So for the next 24, 48 hours, it's going to be a closed-down area as far as traffic getting into that area other than foot traffic. Now, Jennifer from Maryland isn't worried about the number of people actually coming into the area. She says that the huge number of people will make the next few days extremely special.
The amount of people are scared, but this is fun. You know what I'm saying? Meeting different people, different backgrounds, different cultures, having fun with different people just because Obama brought us together. You know what I'm saying? That's real. That's real life right there, and we really appreciate it.
That's nice. And you're going to be live in the middle of it tomorrow.
I am. 16th and I Street on the corner is where we're going to be broadcasting live. We will have free cocoa, free coffee, and we've got a huge big poster of you, John, and Adora. So that should actually bring the crowds in, because it's a great looking picture.
We can only hope, Femi, but we do appreciate the effort. And plus, some of your reports will be on thetakeaway.org. You can check out
they
the blogging, some and of the pictures and some of the sound that you've just shared with us.
Absolutely. And we'll be live all morning tomorrow morning, so I'll see you then.
Inauguration Tourist-in-Chief, we're calling you, Femi.
Oh, thank you.
Femi, okay, many thanks.
I'll bring you back a postcard.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today, the nation is marking MLK Day, commemorating his legacy. And that made us wonder, if he were alive today, what would he be organizing for? What would be at the top of his agenda? What would his agenda look like for 2009? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So a few years ago, when energy officials and business leaders put together the second World Future Energy Summit, they decided to have it in Abu Dhabi, and that wasn't perceived as some sort of joke or an insult to the rest of the world. You may not have heard of Masdar City, but it's actually a planned city in Abu Dhabi to be a carbon neutral city. Does it take a billionaire to make a city that's carbon neutral? Why would a city known for its oil production want to create a carbon neutral city? Well, it's a way of underscoring the seriousness with which business leaders and people who are gathered at the summit are taking the changes that are in order for the sort of fossil fuel oil producers of the world as the entire world moves from a carbon-based energy system to something else. What is that? Well, we've got two guests joining us to talk about it. Jesse Fox, contributing writer for treehugger.com, is currently in Masdar attending the conference. And Andrew Revkin is a reporter for the New York Times.earth blog. He joins us from New York. Good morning to both of you.
It's good to be with you.
So, Jesse,
hi, John, how are you?
Yeah, fine. Jesse, let me begin with you. Why does Abu Dhabi need to worry about a carbon neutral future?
Well, I don't think they really have to worry. I don't think it's really an issue. I mean, they have enough natural gas and oil to last them for 100 years. I think that they're really trying to think ahead. I think they really want to position themselves as a kind of world leader in terms of renewable energy. And I think they figure eventually everybody will be doing it, so why not just go ahead and be the pioneer right now?
Andrew Revkin, we've seen British Petroleum change its name to Beyond Petroleum, or actually, I don't know what that acronym actually means, but it's something like that. How much of this is just atmospherics and marketing, and how much of it is actually a legitimate strategic concern about the future?
Well, the leadership there is pouring a significant amount of their own money into this, so it's not just a mirage. But they are also seeking to attract a lot of investment from outside. Part of the invite is for money to go there under the Kyoto Protocol. Europe has a lot of incentive in investing in projects in developing countries, and despite all the glitz in places like Abu Dhabi, we have to remember they are technically developing countries. So if you're in a rich country in Europe and you want to cut your emissions, you have two choices. You can do expensive things at home, or you can invest in projects through a certain part of that treaty elsewhere. So there's a flow of money going to, or at least until the economic turmoil, there had been a flow of investment money coming from places like Europe toward this project as well. But there's other signs that it's real. MIT, you know, one of the great universities in the world, is building a research center there with the leadership of Abu Dhabi. So it's, not a mirage.
Although there is a lot of investment money available for universities, and Qatar actually has a whole set of university affiliates from the United States that have benefited very much from Qatar's interest in placing U.S. Institutions actually on their territory. But, Jesse, let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. Is it the case, and if it's true, I'm kind of sad about it, that it takes an oil producer's wealth to produce and build a carbon-neutral city in their own territory?
Well, it's no secret that Abu Dhabi has a lot of money. I mean, the government here has a lot of income, a lot of revenue from fossil fuel extraction. And they're very much an oil-based economy, and they're aware of that. But I think the leadership here made a very strategic decision to take all of that wealth and kind of invest it in the future. So, I mean, on the one hand, you're right. It does take a lot of money to invest in these things. I mean, they put up the Masdar Initiative, which is kind of like the umbrella organization that's setting up Masdar City, did receive $15 billion from the government. But in America as well, I mean, the government's talking about investing a lot of money in renewable energy and in energy security and environmental issues in general, including transportation. So I think it's not a model that couldn't be recreated in other places around the world.
Andrew, why do you think Abu Dhabi was inspired now to move towards greendom?
Well, now it was actually a year or two ago. It's a couple of years ago when they, you know, started the plans for this. And remember, things were booming, absolutely booming. And the Emirates in particular, I was there in the 1980s the last time. And when it was really just dusty kind of gold trading outpost. And now it's got some of the world's great towers. I think you heard recently the Emirates, there's some word they're going to build an air-conditioned beach. You know, so there was a lot of money. There's just a vast amount of wealth that, right, they're looking for the future. They know that the world will head increasingly toward renewable energy choices, and they're not stupid.
All right, well, then they may not be stupid, but the question is, in a place with all those towers and all that shiny new building and all of that ostentatious wealth at the World Future Energy Summit, what's there on the agenda, and either of you can answer, for cities like Detroit or Calcutta or, you know, places that really need to take a different kind of strategy rather than giant top-down investments?
Well, actually, if I can answer the question, I mean, just today it was announced here that they made an agreement with Seychelles, which is a very small, you know, island nation that very likely will suffer extreme stress from climate change and rising sea levels. So they signed an agreement with Masdar, the Masdar Initiative, to explore renewable energy. So they're very much trying to make connections with different countries around the world to promote their agenda, which is, I mean, admittedly, very much business-based and investment-based. And it's a business conference. I mean,
sure.
What we see here is a lot of business people. There's a huge exhibition grounds with all the banks, all the oil companies, you know, really fancy exhibits and very, very sleek and very shiny. But the essence of what's going on here is really redirecting business activity towards sustainable energy and sustainable enterprises in general.
And it's a very tricky business in a place like Abu Dhabi, but very interesting issues. The technological and social questions are, of course, on the agenda at the World Future Energy Summit. It's the second annual one being held in Abu Dhabi. Jesse Fox is a contributing writer for treehugger.com and an urban planner based in Tel Aviv. And Andrew Revkin is a reporter for the New York Times.earth blog. Lots to see on our website today and tomorrow, especially tomorrow. Check out our inauguration 2009 page on thetakeaway.org. Live coverage of the inauguration later tomorrow morning with slideshows of Obama's path to the White House, reports from our correspondents, including Femi Oke, who is definitely taking the pulse of Washington, D.C. And we want to hear what you'll be doing tomorrow for the inauguration. Where will you watch? Who will you be with? Are you traveling to D.C.? Are you staying at home? Are you celebrating? Or, you know, we've heard that there are some Republicans who might be mourning. Tell us your inauguration plans at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Mark Garrison is in for Femi Oke, and he's got some headlines for us.
Sure do. It's coming up on 33 minutes after the hour. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has announced another bailout for UK banks, this time in the amount of $147 billion. Brown says the rescue plan is needed as British home prices continue to slide. European markets surged on the news. They've settled down a little bit now. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah says his country will donate $1 billion to help reconstruct the Gaza Strip. There's now a fragile ceasefire there, as Israel says its ground troops will be out quickly as long as Hamas sticks to its ceasefire pledge. It's another showdown in Zimbabwe today at the Rainbow Towers Hotel in Harare. President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai are sitting down to sort out the stalled power-sharing talks. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki and other top African leaders are there to mediate.
Oh, that'll work.
Well,
yeah,
we'll
I'm sure
see.
That'll work.
Things are possible.
Yeah.
Right. In any case. So, obviously, tomorrow we're having a new president. But before that, I want to wind the clock back about 5 years ago today. The Iowa caucuses, John Kerry won, but it was the third-place finisher who gave the most memorable speech.
And we go to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
That seems like another century ago.
Yeah. And actually, it's interesting because people remember the scream, but if you think of all the states that he named, he eventually took over the Democratic Party, and he wanted a 50-state strategy. He wanted to expand, you know, Democrats into the red states. He had some success with that. So as he
I don't know
that.
If that's a full comeback.
Well, no, it's
we
not
call
the
that
White
a
House.
Half comeback. Yeah, that's great. That happened today. 4 years ago today?
Five years ago today.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks very much, Mark. And talking about comebacks in Washington D.C., some Democrats are well, they're enjoying their new power status.
Finally, our moment is here with President-elect Obama and a Democratic Congress with strong majorities. Women and working Americans will have their voices heard.
That's Hilda Sola speaking at an Emily's List lunch, and it's all out with the old and in with the new. Barack Obama takes power tomorrow along with a host of new cabinet secretaries about to be confirmed and a new Congress. Documenting the transfer of power from Republicans to Democrats is The Takeaways, Andrea Bernstein, and she joins us from Washington. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
Now, there are certainly a lot of new faces in Washington, D.C., especially since Democrats have been sitting on the sidelines, chomping at the bit for 8 years, and now it's their time.
That's right. And yesterday I went to the Emily's List pre-inauguration luncheon. Now, Emily's List is the group that raises money for Democratic pro-choice women who are running for office. And I have been to a lot of their events, many of them with Hillary Clinton in the last 8 years. And this is definitely a group that has always felt very much like we're on the outside. We want to be on the inside. And then all of a sudden yesterday, there they are on the inside, all these women that they helped get positioned in power, like Hillary Clinton, Janet Napolitano, who's the new Homeland Security Secretary, if she's confirmed, the designate for the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis. These are all people who are now going to be running the country. And then there was Ellen Moran. She's the new White House Communications Director, and she comes from Emily's List, as a matter of fact. And Ellen Malcolm, who was the founder of Emily's List, yesterday introduced this video.
Are we having a video?
Recognize that music?
Of course.
It's the theme to the West Wing, but what they were showing in this hall full of all of these Democratic women was a sort of YouTube version of the credits with David Axelrod, Rahm Emanuel, Valerie Jarrett, all these people instead of the actual West Wing cast, and Ellen Moran, who was playing the Toby Ziegler role, the communications director of the White House.
That show was canceled, wasn't it? just want to point that out.
But there's a lot of hams. It's a bit hammy, don't you think, Andrea?
Well, you know, but I mean, I think that there's this sense of, you know, we've all been talking in the last couple of weeks and a couple of months about, you know, who's in and who's out and is Obama really going to make change? And this group of Democratic women yesterday was arguing that they've already made change. And for example, there was a lot of talk about the Lilly Ledbetter Paycheck Fairness Act, which is named after a woman who lost her Supreme Court case in pay discrimination. And Congress already voted to redress that. Here's Congresswoman Gwen Moore, speaking at the lunch yesterday of Wisconsin.
And I tell you, the Paycheck Fairness Act, it's just the first step towards stomping out the past 8 years, for sure, of injustice. And not only is Nancy stomping out injustice, but she's stomping it out in 4-inch heels.
That's very intense, Andrea. That's very intense. And clearly lots of pent-up energy in the Democratic Congress now, thinking that perhaps they have a president that will not be vetoing their bills.
That's right. And that's what they kept bringing up, you know, sort of, you know, we control it all now. We can get it done. And one of the most arresting stories was told by the brand new Democratic woman senator from the newly blue state of North Carolina, Kay Hagan.
And, you know, it was about 7 years ago that this Senate seat that I currently hold was held by Jesse Helms. Right. The same Senator Jesse Helms who infamously threw 10 female members of the House of Representatives out of his Senate Foreign Relations hearing room. That's whose seat I am taking.
It sounds like these Democratic women are just really feeling terribly empowered.
Yeah, and not only that, but I mean, they're really talking about the policy differences. And, you know, while we're all sort of focused on the macro, the stimulus bill, the banking, they're focused on these sort of policies that are one level down that they're starting to overturn. Big one where they felt on the outside was reproductive rights. And what was interesting is the new Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. So we're going from sort of Condoleezza Rice, Stanford University, Hoover Institution, very conservative thinking about foreign policy, to Hillary Clinton, who was talking about some of her foreign policy goals being education for all girls, and this one on health care.
Let's work to ensure that women around the world have greater access to health care, especially reproductive health care.
Certainly something different from the Secretary of State that we haven't heard for a while. But as you were describing everything that's happening with the Democrats, I'm wondering about the Republicans, Andrea. Are you running into any of them in Washington?
You know,
what are they up to?
I was pinging my friends in the GOP saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? Well, looks like many of them have left town. Now, there are some bipartisan dinners tonight, but I've heard about trips to New York, a ski trip, and my favorite, Charlie Spies, the former CFO to Mitt Romney's campaign, is holding an inauguration in exile in Las Vegas. The Republicans are clearing out for this mass Democratic event.
But you're not. You're going to be there. You're going to be live tomorrow morning. You're going to be blogging on thetakeaway.org, and you're going to be sending pictures to the website. So people should be on the lookout for that. Andrea Bernstein, thank you.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein is the Takeaway political director, and she's in Washington, D.C., covering the inauguration. She's been meeting with, seeing Democratic women feeling very good about the future.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Ryan Bowen is at 16th and I, smack dab in the center of Washington, D.C. Ryan Bowen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How are your muscles feeling right now, leg muscles?
They're feeling all right. They're feeling a little disoriented because I'm not on the bike right now. It's kind of strange.
Disoriented, yes, because Ryan Bowen, he didn't have enough money to fly to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of Barack Obama, so he decided to ride his bicycle from L.A. to D.C., and you made it. Congratulations, bud.
Well, thank you very much.
And there
you
are.
It's been a great experience.
And there you are in the nation's capital on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. What do you think MLK Jr. would be thinking about this day?
Well, I heard a lot of speculation as for the dream being realized, and I don't know if I would necessarily say that we've come that far, but this is definitely a step, and I believe that we actually have a sincere potential for moving past some of our racial inequalities. I'm very inspired by Obama, and I know that psychologically, many people around the world are looking forward to this as a option to see a new changed America.
And you saw a lot of that America in your trip across the country. And last time I talked with you, you were in warm, sunny Florida, and you had to make a hard left turn and ride north. What was it like to watch the temperature drop?
you know, I'm glad that the last couple of days were the shortest. So the trek up the Atlantic coast was less than a week. And if it was less than 20 degrees for my entire trip, I would have quit back in Texas, I got to say. So I'm glad that it only lasted a couple of days. And it's even warming up this morning, it feels. You know, I was riding in 18-degree weather all the way to Fredericksburg, and that was tough. Very difficult.
Oh, man. Well, you're a better man than I am. So you got a ticket for the inauguration?
I actually did. Yesterday, I was blessed with the opportunity to meet Congressman Earl Blumenauer, representative from Portland, Oregon, my hometown.
That's your hometown?
And yeah. Well, originally from Portland. Yeah. I moved to Los Angeles for college.
And right, right.
He's the biggest bike advocate in Washington, so it was definitely just an amazing experience getting to meet somebody like that who's taking it to him, working on getting billions for improvements in bicycle infrastructure around the country.
Ryan, come on now. You know how things work in Washington, right? I mean, Blumenauer, he's riding you, okay? You're a cult figure because of this show, The Takeaway. You know, America's been following you. Your congressman is basically trying to hitch a ride to your bike.
I got to say, any help I could get, I'll still take it.
What a diplomatic answer. You know, you might be sticking around there in Washington if you talk like that. What face most typifies the sense of hope that you imagine that your trip would embody as you traveled across the country? And you don't have to answer. You can think about that because we're going to be talking to you on Wednesday when this whole thing comes full circle and you'll have actually experienced the inauguration that you dreamed of. But is it fair to say that the faces were really urging you along and not thinking you were kind of ridiculous?
You know what? The one question that I asked that had some of the most interesting answers is, if you had one thing to say to Barack Obama, you know, what would that be? And so I got a lot of that on the video camera as we were going along. And, you know, the main face that I guess I could put to it was a woman back in Austin, Texas, who was just like, just keep it real, Barack. You know,
it was
a simple statement, and, you know, that sums it all up.
All right.
Just want to make sure that everybody is just keeping that happening.
All right, well, Ryan Bone, get your hand warmers. Stay warm. You've made it. You don't need to get on the bike again. You're at 16th and I in Washington, D.C. Ryan Bone traveled from L.A. to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of Barack Obama. Thanks, Ryan.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 19th. Mark Arison is in for Femi Oke, and he's got the headlines.
Thank you. Coming up on 48 minutes after the hour, Israel says it will have all of its troops out of the Gaza Strip by tomorrow. It's the first official mention of a withdrawal timeline. That's only, of course, if Hamas holds its fire. Hamas declared a week-long ceasefire over the weekend. The FDA is asking people to hold off on eating food containing peanut butter while it investigates a salmonella outbreak. Peanut butter sold in jars in grocery stores is not a part of the recall, but cookies, cakes, ice cream and crackers, things like that that have peanut butter in them, those are suspect. Little Debbie is among the companies issuing a recall. Nearly 500 people in 43 states have gotten sick so far. A major supply route for U.S. troops in Afghanistan has reopened. Pakistan closed the Khyber Pass briefly because of suspected insurgent attacks. Western troops in Afghanistan receive up to 75% of their supplies through that road. Power-sharing talks in Zimbabwe are resuming this week. President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai meet today. The talks have been stalled for the past 4 months. President-elect Barack Obama wants Americans to observe the Martin Luther King holiday by volunteering. He, the vice president-elect, and their wives will all work on service projects today. The idea they're supporting, if you've got a day off work, you know, why not use it to do something good in the community? Tonight, the president-elect will also appear at several dinners honoring John McCain and Colin Powell. There was a nice moment. There's been a lot of speculation about his inauguration speech tomorrow, and then his daughter, Sasha, when she heard about Lincoln's second inaugural address, she saw it. I was like, God, that was a really long speech. Do you have to give one of those? He's like, actually, yeah, my speech might even be a little longer. So we will see. The family's been building up the pressure on him.
You know, Benjamin Harrison gave a two-hour speech, caught a cold,
and died
in office.
It didn't end well for him.
Very cold weather.
Obama, he's well padded against
that's good.
He'll have a warm coat on.
They got heaters in that the pavilion that they built in front of the Capitol. Thank you very much.
It's going to be magic.
So there's history going to be made in Washington, but there's going to be history recalled on at least one set of plates for certain individuals who will be lunching on Inauguration Day. Joining us is Melissa Clark, food writer for the New York Times, and she has brought us a taste of what the president will be dining on tomorrow. And our studio smells so good because of all this delicious food. We love it when you come in here, Melissa. But I was told that Barack Obama will eat a lunch tomorrow that is modeled after an actual lunch that Abraham Lincoln had many, many years ago. Please explain.
Well, it's not modeled after one particular lunch that Abraham Lincoln had. In fact, the inaugural luncheon is a fairly recent party. They didn't used to have inaugural luncheons until 1953. Before that, it was more of a casual thing. But what the lunch is, what Barack Obama is going to eat tomorrow is based on Abraham Lincoln's favorite foods.
Really?
Yeah. So historically, what they did was they went to the White House records and they dug up meals that he had in the past, and they went through his diaries and letters and looked for ingredients that he said that he loved. For example, one thing that you've got in front of you right there is apples. It's I made a little apple Charlotte, and Abraham Lincoln loved apples. Who knew? He also loved wild game birds. He loved seafood. So the menu tomorrow is based on all these things. And let me tell you what it is, because it looks really good. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit stodgy, but I would say that it's very historically accurate. We've got a seafood stew, which is Abraham Lincoln loved oysters. Oysters were a luxury item back then. They're still a luxury item. So this seafood stew is made with oysters and lobster and scallops. It's put into a cream sauce, puff pastry on top, baked in the oven, and that's the first course.
That sounds good.
Second course, wild game birds. We've got pheasant and duck with a cherry chutney, which I also brought you some cherry chutney to taste.
And you made this.
I did. Well, we wanted to get into the spirit of the inauguration at our house, too, so we had a little pre-inaugural feast ourselves.
Now, tell me a little bit about chutney. It's always been kind of a mystery food to me, because you look at what's in the chutney and you go, I don't recognize anything. And you say to yourself, so how do you make chutney? What distinguishes chutney from, say, any other kind of preserve or something?
It's the spices.
Uh-huh.
Because chutneys are filled with amazing spices. And this one has cumin and it has cinnamon and clove and all kinds of wonderful things. And that just gives it this deep, rich flavor.
I was really struck in looking at some of the recipes. They are so labor intensive.
Oh my God, yes.
And I think that really speaks to the time period when there was a lot of help in the White House.
There's still a lot of help in the White House. The caterers that they have just, I'm sure, have tons of staff. But yeah, back then, I mean, this was a meal that would have taken probably at least two or three people in the kitchen for every single guest. And today, well, there's about 200 guests, but sometimes they had thousands of guests for these meals. So we're talking about just an intense amount of people who are, you know, cooking for them.
I mean, listen to her rattling off facts about chutney and Lincoln and all this. I mean, New York Times food writer, I mean, you know, this is the New York Times. This is our partners. This is the strength of our partnership here. So Melissa Clark.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you.
So what's the main dish? What's the main dish?
The main course is what they're calling a brace of American birds, pheasant and duck, with sour cherry chutney and whipped molasses sweet potatoes. And
Sounds so great.
I know. It's really, it's going to be, I think they're going to enjoy that dish a lot. What they've done, though, is instead of using a typical, you know, normally when you have game birds, they're roasted. They've made it a little bit more fancy, and they've taken the breast off the birds, and they've prepared the breast separately. So the president doesn't have to deal with bones or anything like that. He's just got the beautiful breast meat on the plate. So.
But there's also logic.
No chewing.
It's just an IV. But there's some logic for that. I mean, particularly with game birds, you cook the breast separately because it cooks at a different rate and it dries out much more easily.
Especially with pheasant. That's a great point. And this pheasant that they're serving is stuffed with wild rice. So it's going to be really moist and delicious, I think.
Now, long before he was president-elect and long before he was even senator, when he was just a person who might wander into a cooking show on a public TV station in Chicago, Illinois, Barack Obama said this as kind of his deep food aesthetic.
I'm not looking for some fancy presentation or, you know, extraordinarily subtle flavors. I mean, what I'm looking for is food that tastes good for a good price.
That's Barack Obama back in 2001 on WTTW's program Check Please, which is all about like restaurant reviews in Chicago. Probably not a good price, this meal.
Well, he's not. Well, I guess he's sort of paying out of pocket, actually, since it's his budget
exactly.
Now, right?
That's right.
But it should be good food that tastes good. I think it's going to be a little on the fancy side for him, but I think he'll enjoy it.
Do you think that's consistent with the Lincoln idea here, that Lincoln maybe had food that he loved but was not someone who, you know, went out of his way to eat extravagant food when he was in the White House?
Oh, I'm sure he didn't. You know, he had a very modest upbringing. That's one thing that links him to future President Obama, is a very modest upbringing. And I think that the foods that he loved would have been prepared very simply. You know, I think what we're getting today is it's just gone upscale. It's gone one or two steps fancier because, well, you know, that's the time. So.
And they're both two, you know, amazing American stories, Barack Obama and Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you mentioned that he had modest upbringing, but it was also an upbringing in the middle of the frontier. I mean, in southern Illinois, Kentucky, the log cabin upbringing. I mean, you know, this cuisine is very much the kind of thing that families would subsist on. He grew up with foods that, you know, came from, you know, like the acres, you know, just across the hill.
Oh, yeah. He would have been shooting these birds.
Exactly.
They would not have been farm-raised. He would have been out there getting his own. And he definitely wouldn't have taken the breast off and stuffed it with the nice wild rice. I mean, it would have been a much more rustic presentation.
And, you know, there's an environmental story there, too. Oysters were abundant back in the middle 1800s.
Were.
I mean, not like today. I mean, I bet his oysters tasted much better than our oysters.
Well, you know, it's interesting because he was in the middle of the country. You know, he grew up in Indiana and Kentucky. It's not exactly oyster central there. They had to be shipped a long distance from the East Coast or from, from the East Coast probably. And so that was what made them a luxury item, was the travel, transport, getting those oysters fresh to the middle of the
luxury
country.
Not in Baltimore, but certainly in Springfield, Illinois. Well, Melissa Clark, as always, it is a delight. And I need to say goodbye to you so that I can start eating the food that you left
please.
Here. So Melissa Clark, food writer for The New York Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
She's always so wonderful, isn't she?
I got my food.
Well, then I'll keep talking. Today, of course, is MLK Day. And if Martin Luther King were alive, what would he be organizing? What would he organize millions to march for? And what would be on his agenda in 2009? What would he see from the top of the mountain? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And want to remind you, we will be live from the streets of Washington, D.C. tomorrow for the inauguration with our very own Femi Okeh, Andrea Bernstein, and Todd Zwillick.
Zwillick got, I think he's like right next to Barack.
At the podium.
Yeah, he's
practically right
there.
On the podium. He was fighting for that spot. So we are going to enjoy that tomorrow. So there'll be lots to see on that. And you can check it out, Inauguration 2009. We have a page on our website at thetakeaway.org. And live coverage again of everything, including slideshows of Obama's path to the White House. And we also want to hear what you'll be doing for the inauguration. Where will you watch it? What will you be? Who will you be with? Or as some of you told us last week, you're just going to go to sleep through the day and wait for it to all be over. Anyhow, give us your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought for a takeaway for today.
They've gone skiing. They've gone to Vegas. They've gone to New York. So the Republicans are not sticking around for all this hoopla this week.
Not sticking around. That's the takeaways. Andrea Bernstein in D.C. talking about what's happening this week as the power shifts in Washington from the Republicans to the Democrats. Out with the old, in with the new. At least that's what they say. We're always on. And if you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry with the GOP in Las Vegas playing the crap tables. This is The Takeaway.
You wish.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
T-shirts are maybe still available, but the really important inauguration souvenirs are selling out.
Heaters, all of our portable heaters, hand warmers. We are selling through tons and tons of hand warmers, shoe warmers, keys, hundreds and hundreds of keys, wet dry vacs, utility pumps, sump pumps.
At D.C.'s Logan Hardware Store, General Manager Drew Sutter says the north winds are dampening no spirits. Washington's cold snap cannot chill the warmth hundreds of thousands of people brought for Obama's inauguration. When hands are cold and hearts are warm, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 19th. John, what are they doing with wet dry vacs? Like, what would you be doing with that?
Just trying to keep things dry. It's the keys. It's also interesting. It's for all the people who are renting out their apartments.
Interesting. Well, we're going to have more today on what's happening in Washington, D.C. as the capital prepares for Barack Obama's inauguration. We also have the latest on the new ceasefire in the Middle East, as well as some talk about Guantanamo Bay and its detention center. Perhaps the days are numbered. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
Hundreds of thousands gathered at the Lincoln Memorial yesterday to kick off the inauguration with a concert. One Takeaway producer says President-elect Barack Obama was particularly moved by the tunes of Mary J. Blige. At the close of the concert, the president-elect addressed the crowd. He says a nation's true character comes through during the hard times.
I ask you to help reveal that character once more. And together, we can carry forward as one nation and one people the legacy of our forefathers that we celebrate today.
Today we're celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King Day, and the president-elect has asked all citizens to honor the day with a day of service. He'll be volunteering with his family.
Overseas, Israel is pulling its troops out of the Gaza Strip. The military has promised to have them all out by tomorrow. Israeli Major General Giora Eland says its goals have been met.
We have good reasons to believe now that Hamas will avoid shooting against Israeli targets for quite a long time. And since this was the most important objective of this operation, we have good reasons to be very satisfied.
Israel says the ceasefire will be valid as long as Hamas holds its fire. Hamas declared a week-long truce yesterday.
Apparently, our news writer Mark Garrison has never had salmonella. This is his story. Peanut butter crackers are a good 7 a.m. snack, but the FDA is asking customers not to eat food products containing peanut butter while it investigates a salmonella outbreak. That means crackers, cakes, and cookies. But don't fret, Fluffernutter lovers. Mark Garrison writes, peanut butter straight from the jar is still okay. All right, so the Super Bowl is going to be this. The Pittsburgh Steelers against the Arizona Cardinals. That was the result of yesterday's games. Wall Street is closed today for a holiday, and oil is trading around $35 a barrel in Europe.
And we want to hear about what you're doing for the inauguration. Where are you going to watch? Who are you going to be with? Are you staying home? Are you celebrating it with your children? Are you just ignoring the day altogether and just going to work? We want to hear what you are up to as we get a new president tomorrow. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
I'm an election guy. I don't go in for these inaugurations. They feel like a coronation.
But they are, essentially. They're a coronation of our vote.
Thought we'd solve that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Yesterday, after a three-week offensive, Israeli officials announced a unilateral ceasefire, with Prime Minister Ehud Olmert saying their goals had been reached by badly damaging Hamas's ability to wage war on Israel. Then Hamas announced its own week-long ceasefire. And for more, we talked to Bethany Bell, a BBC correspondent in Jerusalem, and I asked her what Hamas's one-week ceasefire meant and what Hamas wants to happen for it to be extended.
They say the Israeli army should withdraw from Gaza in this week, and they want also to see the border crossings of Gaza opened up again. There's been very, very restricted access over these borders for the last year and a half, and they say they want those border crossings open, but most important, they want to see the Israeli troops withdraw.
And that first point, the Israeli troops have begun pulling troops out of Gaza. Do they plan to pull all of the troops out of Gaza?
Well, the Israeli army, when I spoke to a spokesman from there a little bit earlier on, they're not giving any details as to how quickly this is going to happen or how many have already come out. What they are saying is that the process is continuing. And I've also heard from an Israeli security official saying that some of the reservists who'd been called up have now been told they can go home. So I think there is a suggestion, a feeling here that this is coming to some sort of conclusion. People are coming out. But I think the troops also remain on high alert in case the ceasefire is broken.
Have there been any reports today of Hamas launched missiles into Israel?
No. Today, the Israeli army says it's been quiet. Yesterday, before Hamas announced its ceasefire, there were still rocket fired out of Gaza. But since pretty much overnight was very, very quiet, today we've heard no reports of any kind of rockets. So the ceasefire does seem to be holding.
And meanwhile, does Egypt continue to try to broker a formal ceasefire, a more formal agreement between Israel and Hamas?
Well, diplomatic efforts are still going on to try and sort of firm up the ceasefire, if you like. But there's a problem here in that Israel and Hamas don't talk to each other. Egypt has been carrying out negotiations separately with the Israelis, with Hamas, to try and figure out. Now, what Israel has been saying is that one of its key demands was to stop Hamas from being able to rearm in the future. And a couple of days ago, the Israeli foreign minister came to the U.S. and got an agreement to help prevent Hamas from resmuggling, sort of to get some sort of agreement to allow there to be more cooperation between the U.S. and Israel in terms of intelligence, so what we understand, to stop the weapons coming into Gaza in the first place.
So, Bethany, is it your sense that this ceasefire may be the result of the fact of the new administration in the U.S. coming in tomorrow, because neither side wanting to be fighting on a day that Barack Obama takes office? Or is there some material movement, some substantive movement in the discussions that have been happening diplomatically?
Well, I certainly think that there's a sense in Israel that, you know, the Israelis don't want to blot their copybook with a new U.S. president. They don't want there to be fighting when Barack Obama is sworn in. Also, there's been a lot of international pressure for this to stop. We've seen large casualties on the Palestinian side. From Hamas's perspective, it's taken a very severe battering over the last 3 weeks. The Israeli army says it's destroyed a lot of the military infrastructure that Hamas has. So I think there is a sense, you know, on all sides that perhaps, you know, the time has come to sort of wind things down. But as I say, things are still quite fragile. We had the Israeli prime minister yesterday saying that the ceasefire he felt was fragile and that the troops were monitoring it from minute to minute. But I think all sides really are happy to see a pause in the fighting at the moment.
Bethany Bell, thank you very much. Bethany Bell is a BBC correspondent, and she was reporting to us from Jerusalem.
Well, Ethan Bronner of the New York Times said on this program about 2.5 weeks ago that this would all be over by the inauguration of Barack Obama. And indeed, that is what has appeared to come to pass, although, as Adora says, the fragile ceasefire is holding only for the moment. But as late as January 16th, Condoleezza Rice was still doing last-minute diplomacy.
America is not without its ability to make mistakes like anyone can. But it is also a country that tries to do the right thing. Not always the easy thing, but the right thing.
Sounding as though she's saying goodbye, but in very many ways, both on the foreign front and on the economic front, this will be a handoff in the end zone for the Bush team to the Obama team, as there are many serious issues in the midst of all the pomp and circumstance that Obama was in the middle of yesterday.
There is no doubt that our road will be long, that our climb will be steep, but never forget that the true character of our nation is revealed not during times of comfort and ease, but by the right we do when the moment is hard.
The moment is hard, and to help us explain what's going on in this moment, beneath all the pomp and circumstance, is our very own Todd Zwillick in Washington from Capital News Connection, fully credentialed for the inauguration ceremonies. Todd, what signs are there even now in the midst of the party atmosphere in Washington that the moment is hard and that the serious business of governing this week is going to emerge full scale once the inauguration is over?
Well,
The biggest sign, the most obvious sign, is how packed the schedule is just as soon as the pomp and circumstance is done with, John. You have House hearings scheduled for Wednesday noon. Before the House even reconvenes officially, House committees will start processing and crunching the numbers on that big $825 billion stimulus, which we wouldn't need if things weren't extraordinarily hard, as you mentioned. So they get right down to work even before the House officially convenes Wednesday.
Now, we've seen that Barack Obama has a significant amount of momentum in mobilizing congressional majorities for his legislative initiatives in a couple of instances last week. But what's the chance that the Republicans are going to make a stand on the stimulus package here?
Well, it's the chances are pretty good. They're going to try to make a stand on it, I would imagine. But let's before we get down to it, let's look at the raw numbers. 256 Democrats, 178 Republicans, and one vacancy, Rahm Emanuel's seat in Illinois. That's nearly an 80-vote swing. So Republican opposition to this, if Democrats hold together, and on the stimulus they will hold together, Republican opposition is going to be largely symbolic. But they have been starting to make noises and trying to poke holes in the advisability of this stimulus. John Boehner's office, the Republican leader, has started putting out somewhat humorous missives about the size of the stimulus and what you could buy for the money. Give you a couple of examples. They put out a list the other day. They called it a dozen fun facts about the House Democrats' massive spending bill. $825 billion is enough to give every man, woman, and child in America $2,700 cash. We'll write you a check, and it would be the exact same thing.
See, I would have hoped it had been more than that. I would have hoped it had been more than $2,700. That's kind of sad.
Like an even $3,500,
maybe? Maybe $5,000. I don't know.
$825 billion, that's enough to give – John Boehner's from Ohio. It's enough to give every person in Ohio $72,000, and on and on. And some of them are substantive. They're starting to point out some of the aspects of the bill that they don't feel are stimulative. This is supposed to be directly creating or preserving jobs. There's $650 million in the bill for digital TV coupons, you know, for the high-definition switch.
Sure.
Not a bad idea, but is it stimulative? Who knows? Yeah. So they're starting to point these things out.
All right. Two more things before we go. S-CHIP, that's the, child healthcare initiative that passed overwhelmingly in the House. The Senate's going to take it up. Is that a no-brainer? And what evidence do we have that Middle East policy is going to be front and center anytime this week?
It is a no-brainer. The Senate will pass it. I'm not sure if they'll get to it next week. There may not be time, but if not, they'll get to it the week after. And it's likely to be the one of the first, if not the first, bill that Obama signs into law as president. Mideast policy, I haven't seen any hearings scheduled. Hillary Clinton's nomination has been cleared by the Foreign Relations Committee, so that won't come up. Her nomination will be on the floor probably by next week, but I don't know. They don't have a plan to debate it. They might just rubber stamp it. If they debate it, there might be speeches on the floor about Mideast policy, and the Senate might want to put a marker down on Gaza. So that's a possibility.
Well, it's interesting. With all this sort of congressional Johnson-style, LBJ-style negotiating between Barack Obama and congressional leaders, plus Barack Obama makes a visit to Ohio to do a kind of a bully pulpit speech on his economic stimulus, there is a lot going on in Washington. And Todd Zwillick, we're grateful that you're there in the middle of it. Thanks so much.
Well, enjoy the pomp and circumstance, John.
Oh, Todd, you know what a grump I am about that sort of thing. Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection.
Despite the enormity of the task that lies ahead, I stand here today as hopeful as ever that the United States of America will endure, that it will prevail, that the dream of our founders will live on in our time.
Barack Obama speaking yesterday. Don't listen to me. We want to hear what you'll be doing tomorrow for the inauguration. Where will you watch? Who will you be with? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. With all the focus on D.C. for tomorrow's presidential inauguration, what are you doing in your own community?
I work at a community center in the East Village, and a while back somebody donated a large screen TV, which we have not really found a use for, but we're going to set it up tomorrow in our big community room, and our preschool is going to gather there along with our senior members, and we're all really excited because there'll be a diverse population of our clients watching together and sharing the memorable occasion.
Lots of sharing going on out there. We want to hear what your plans are and what's happening in your community. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we're talking about Barack Obama's inauguration tomorrow.
Inaugurate rhymes with tailgate. It's an inaugurate party. That's what people are going to have. We want to hear your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE. So wherever he is, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is undoubtedly looking down at the inauguration with a smile on his face at this moment in history. Also at the inauguration is going to be all the surviving members of the Tuskegee Airmen, a group of elite African-American World War II pilots. President-elect Barack Obama has explicitly credited them with helping to pave the way for his presidency and invited them to the inauguration. Their performance in combat helped persuade Harry Truman to desegregate the military in 1948. And one of those surviving airmen is Val Archer, who joins us now from Washington, D.C. Val Archer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And I guess you turn 80 this year, but turning 80 is probably not the big headline for you compared with attending this inauguration, right?
Not in the least.
So how important, first of all, when did you get the invitation? And do you think Barack Obama is right that you helped pave the way for his presidency?
I believe so. I think the Tuskegee Airmen and the Buffalo Soldiers and the Golden 13 and a number of African-American military organizations contributed largely to establishing a base that President Truman was able to react to.
And I think, you know, Colin Powell has talked about this in the past as well, that the military's experience with desegregation has been so successful and such a model for the rest of, you know, American society, that often African-Americans, when they leave the military, note the relative segregation in American society at large compared to where they come from in the military. Did you have that experience?
The experience that I had early on, of course, was with extreme segregation and discrimination many different facets. And reentering civilian life, it was sort of nondescript. We were totally ignored for the most part. But I believe today it's so much better largely because of the struggles from the institution of desegregation in 1949 through the Vietnam War. A lot transpired, and I think it had about 20 years or so to shake itself out into better policy, better understanding, and a more honest and human relationships among the troops.
And I was just wondering, can you, listening to people talk about what these days mean, what tomorrow's means, can you put into words what it's going to mean for you to be there and witness the first African-American being inaugurated?
Oh, my feelings will be on many different levels. Besides appreciating the struggle, the relative struggle that we've been engaged in over the period, particularly since the end of World War II and through the Civil Rights Movement, through today, our activities have been such that we had, in the instance of Tuskegee Airmen, for example, our mission was continuing to work with young people and to provide opportunities for them and encouragement and help them develop focus and maintain a sense of identity and integrity and to accept our legacy as a responsibility to carry on into the next generation.
Val,
and I feel that yes.
Did you believe that Barack Obama would actually be president when he began his campaign, and you watched this all along?
I did very shortly after the beginning. I was fortunate enough to meet him during the period when we were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal last year. And I just coincidentally, I was introduced to him And I thought that this was a very, very charismatic young man, and I thought that he had a real future. And not, I wasn't thinking in terms of the president, but fortunately it did turn out to be that way.
Oh, well, it's an amazing story. And I notice here, just before, I have to ask you about this. You enlisted in the airmen when you were 15 years old?
Yes, I was.
So you must have had to tell them a little bit of a story about how old you really were?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
In fact, I was following some of the older guys that I sort of hung out with.
Right.
But more than that, I think it may have been they were so busy on that particular day when I tried to enlist that they sort of looked the other way.
They sort
maybe
of looked
they
the other.
Needed a quota.
Right. Well, I have to ask you, since you sort of fudged the actual age back then, are you really turning 80 this year?
I'll be 80 on the 13th of April, my grandmother's birthday.
Oh, great story. Val Archer is one of the surviving Tuskegee Airmen who will be at Barack Obama's inauguration. And right here in the studio is Mark Garrison with the headlines.
Yeah, so it's about coming up on 28 minutes after the hour. And we're hearing a lot about tomorrow, the swearing-in, the parade, the balls. But obviously the fun stops on Wednesday, and the president-elect's now his transition team. Later they'll be his administration. They're giving a preview of kind of what's going on once he drops the elect part of president-elect. And senior aides say he'll start by meeting with top economic advisors. Then he'll meet with military brass to map out a change to the mission in Iraq, including appointing at least one envoy to deal with Middle East crises. And to round out his first full day on the job, he's expected to issue several executive orders on issues ranging from the environment to detaining terror suspects. A lot to do.
What happens to the elect? Is that put like in the Smithsonian until there's the next
president?
Yeah,
until you know, 4 years or 8 years.
They
yeah.
Carry, there's like someone that actually takes
it
away.
Oh, yeah, next to the ball gowns.
The elect.
Yeah.
I see. Great.
Yeah,
great.
In the like Garamond font, I
Thank
think
you.
It is.
Thank you.
In any case, also going on, Britain has revealed a second bailout plan for its banks, this time for $147 billion. It's aimed at protecting the country's banks from bad assets, which is believed this move would boost lending. Markets in Europe initially cheered the news. They were soaring earlier, but now they've slipped a bit. Most Asian markets closed with modest gains this morning. Wall Street, of course, is closed for the King holiday. In Afghanistan, officials say a suicide car bomb near the gates of a U.S. base killed one Afghan and wounded six more. A second suicide bomber was waiting for emergency officials to respond, but police spotted him and he detonated his explosives, ending up killing only himself. Super Bowl is set. The Pittsburgh Steelers will take on the Arizona Cardinals. In entertainment, the weekend box office, Paul Blart Mall Cop was the top movie, followed by Grand Torino, Clint Eastwood, and My Bloody Valentine, Notorious. That's a Biggie Smalls movie that we talked about last week, and Hotel for Dogs round out the top five.
Hmm. Boy, so, you got through those stories fast. Thanks, Marquette Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. All eyes are on D.C. for tomorrow's inauguration, but there must be something going on in your community.
Hi, this is Kathleen Walsh. I'm calling from Wall Township, New Jersey. For the inauguration, I'm planning on canceling my office hours, and I'm keeping both my elementary school children home from school. We're going to stay in our Obama pajamas for the day, and we're not going to miss 1 minute of it.
Obama people in their pajamas all over America. We want to hear your plans and what's happening locally. Are you doing something a little different? Maybe something offbeat to mark tomorrow's change of presidents? Inaugurate rhymes with tailgate. If you're having a party, tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And still in D.C., though, they are expecting millions. Not everyone's going to be at home in their pajamas. Though you wouldn't necessarily guess some of them are coming from Alaska. During the election, the cheers of Alaskan Obama voters were certainly drowned out by the commotion and support for Governor Sarah Palin,
who was the vice presidential nominee on the presidential ticket, but there were thousands who supported the president-elect in the predominantly Republican state, and some of them have made the long trip to Washington to celebrate. Longtime Obama fan Curran Fisher is one Alaskan who's in D.C. She joins us now along with Libby Casey, a reporter from Alaska Public Radio. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Corinne, so was it lonely being an Obama supporter all the way out there or up there in Alaska?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, Libby and I were talking this morning about the whole election process. And for me, it goes back almost a year to the Super Tuesday primaries or the caucus in Alaska. And it was 45 below there, and they actually had to split the caucusing out into two locations and ended up exceeding capacity at both of them. So that was just the thing that kicked off all of this excitement. And there's, you know, certainly Sarah Palin on the ticket was a factor, and it generated a lot of chatter in state. But I got a lot of calls and friends of mine that are definitely on the other side of the aisle who are really excited for me to be here today.
And when Corinne says 45 below, she means 45 degrees below zero. People brave that kind of a cold to caucus that day.
I think I skipped over that because I just can't even begin to imagine what that's like. But Libby, really,
it's really
I think it's easy.
Than New York in the teens.
I'm sure. Libby, it's easy to have missed that, though, this sense that there was some support for Obama in Alaska because, well, first of all, the state went for the Republican ticket. And second of all, the Republican supporters were far more visible. I mean, have you come across lots of folks like Corinne?
Absolutely. Alaska is predominantly a Republican state, and having your governor on the ticket is a big deal. I mean, we're not usually in the spotlight like that as Alaskans, but there is this hardcore group of people who were supportive of Barack Obama, and the delegation, Alaska's senators and congressmen, have been flooded with requests for tickets. They got thousands more requests than they could possibly meet. Corinne booked her flight to come from Alaska just hoping that Obama would win back in March.
I know, and I want to talk to her.
Find out until like a month ago that you actually got tickets to come, right?
I mean, Corinne, this is like a leap of faith. It's almost as if you had a crystal ball and knew something that a whole lot of other folks didn't because you made plans back in March?
I did. And D.C. is my hometown, so not only the excitement for Obama, but I really wanted to be here to see the atmosphere in the city and just really the hometown celebration. But I was booking a mileage ticket, and I figure if things don't go the way I want them to, all I have to do is cancel it, and I'm out $100. If things go the way I want them to, wow.
But still, talk about
so pretty.
Yeah, talk about thinking ahead. And can you really put, what is it about Barack Obama? What is it about this election that had you thinking so hopefully all that time ago?
I think it was his persona and his character and just a sense of intelligence, and that here is somebody who is really going to look at the way things are working in the world and work at them in a collaborative way. And it's definitely panned out in seeing the cabinet selections and the way he's been in the last couple of months that the sense of partisanship seems to be dissipating a bit. And it's so strange compared to what D.C. has been and what the perception of D.C. has been, and so exciting, too. And just the thought that if you're an American abroad, and I have a number of friends from high school and college who are living abroad, that it's suddenly cool to be an American again. And who would have thought?
If there's one thing that you'd like to see Barack Obama do, let's say, the first 100 days, what would it be?
Oh, boy. Put me on the spot.
Well,
I don't know if I could even think of one thing for the first 100 days.
There's something for you to think about there. But quickly, lastly, to you, Libby, it's interesting because our own Famioke is actually in Washington, and who has she run into but some people who've traveled from Anchorage, Alaska?
Yeah, there are a ton of people here. Corinne was on the plane coming down here and said it was full of people coming to inauguration. We're going to go to an event later on today. The delegation and the Alaska State Society is hosting a gathering, and they're expecting hundreds of people to turn out. There are a couple of groups that are going to be marching in the parade, Alaska Native dancers. So if you're going to be on the parade route, keep a lookout for them. But, you know, I've talked to a fair number of Alaska Natives who are very passionate about Barack Obama because they see a civil rights leader. They see this as a momentous day. And on Martin Luther King Day, very exciting for some of them to come down and celebrate someone who's not white being the president of America. That's a very exciting time.
And these Alaskans are easy to pick out, Libby, because they're the ones in the short sleeve shirts there in the heat wave of Washington.
No, no, we're the ones with the sensible parka and the warm mukluks and the neck gaiters and the hats because it's cold here.
No concern about fashion. Warmth is the key.
Well, thank you both very much. Libby Casey, reporter for Alaska Public Radio, and Corinne Fisher, an Alaskan Obama supporter who is attending the inauguration. And now Mark Garrison is here with some headlines for us.
Thank you. Coming up on 39 minutes after the hour, Israeli officials say ground troops will be out of the Gaza Strip by tomorrow. Over the weekend, Israel declared a ceasefire. Hamas did the same not long after. The full Israeli pullout will only happen if Hamas holds its fire. More than 1,200 Palestinians and 13 Israelis have died in the conflict. A lot of damage to clean up there, of course. News this morning that Saudi Arabia's king is pledging $1 billion in rebuilding money for Gaza Strip. Ukraine's prime minister is heading to Moscow to sign a deal aimed at restoring gas supplies to Europe. Russia cut off gas to Europe via Ukraine earlier this month. This left a chunk of Europe scrambling to find the energy for winter heat and lights. Ukraine and Russia reached a preliminary deal over the weekend for Ukraine to get gas with a 20% discount from average European prices. In honor of the Martin Luther King holiday, President-elect Barack Obama plans to do some community service in D.C. today. He, the vice president-elect, and their wives will all work on service projects today. The idea they're supporting, if you've got a day off work, you know, why not use it to do something good in the community? The President-elect will also appear at several dinners tonight. Honorees include John McCain and Colin Powell. Military judges in a Guantanamo war crimes court will go ahead with hearings for five men accused of plotting the 9/11 terror attacks. It's believed the incoming Obama administration will quickly suspend the commissions, but a request to postpone the hearings by legal teams on both sides was rejected. With cases turning up in China, the World Health Organization is concerned about bird flu spreading as Chinese New Year approaches. Tens of millions of people will be on the move, and chicken and duck are fixtures in celebration feasts there. The Super Bowl is set. It will be the Pittsburgh Steelers against the Arizona Cardinals February 1st in Tampa. Super Bowl 43 will be the first ever for the Cardinals. That leaves five teams that have actually never made it. That's the Cleveland Browns, Detroit Lions, New Orleans Saints, Jacksonville Jaguars, and Houston Texans.
And Kurt Warner is the story.
He is.
That's for sure. I mean, he's got a lot to prove. How old is he? Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And as we've heard, Tuskegee Airmen will be in the audience at the inauguration, thousands of people from Alaska. And along the parade route and throughout Washington, D.C. this week, the theme is diversity, all sorts of different kinds of faces at the inauguration. And nothing says diversity, deep American diversity, like Pat Monahan, a co-founder of the world-famous Lawn Rangers, who's also going to be at the inauguration. Pat, good morning.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Great. So you met Barack Obama in 2003.
That's correct.
Tell me about the meeting.
Well, I was at the St. Patrick's Day parade in Chicago. He was running for the Democratic primary. He and Michelle were handing out literature before the parade started, and we were doing our usual warm-up, practicing a few things.
Could we just talk about your usual warm-up? That means you were sitting on a lawnmower, right?
Sometimes we actually practice. We run a rookie camp, make sure everybody knows what they're doing, because we're not a real tight organization. We draft people at the last minute and put them to work. But we had a core group of constituents that had marched many times before.
Who ride lawnmowers in parades, and were you holding a toilet plunger when you spoke with the candidate, Barack Obama?
That's the tip-off that we knew he'd be a great leader. He came up to us. He did not want to push the mower. He went straight for the leadership position, the plunger man. So
I see.
Spotted him early.
Well, we should say the world-famous Lawn Rangers are among one of the organizations, and 1,400 applied to be in the parade. And apparently Barack Obama has a sense of humor because he remembered you from 2003, and the Arcola, Illinois world-famous Lawn Rangers have marched in, you know, thousands of parades. So what does it mean to you, you know, in terms of the legacy of this organization, that Barack Obama basically said, sure, come on, we want you in the parade?
You know, I think it's a great honor for us, and we're real excited about being part of it. But I think it also says a little bit about our new president-elect in that he does recognize humor and that people are going to have to keep their sense of humor and they are going to have to be able to laugh at themselves, which is maybe our strength.
Now, just to get to the message part of the conversation here, you are an organization that fuses Abraham Lincoln with riding lawnmowers. And is that going to be the message that you're going to be portraying in the parade tomorrow?
I think we'll have our own set of diversity. We actually push lawnmowers. We tried running them, and they throw rocks in the crowd and all kinds of adverse outcomes. So
smart move.
We just push mowers, but each mower is decorated individually, and we have, for example, a Washington Monument on one mower. We have a huge papier-mâché Abraham Lincoln on another. We have what we used to call Banner Babes with a B, but we changed them to Banner Abes because they'll all be dressed as Lincolns carrying our banners.
Any biodiesel in the fuel tanks of these lawnmowers? Come on, you got it. Come on. No,
it really wouldn't matter what was in there, but we could put some in there.
All right. Well, Pat Monahan, thanks so much for joining us. He's the co-founder of the world-famous Lawn Rangers, who will be in the inauguration parade tomorrow on the parade route in D.C. Thanks, Pat.
Yeah, thank you, John. See you tomorrow.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 19th. Mark Garrison is in for Femi Okeh, and he's got the headlines of the hour.
Thank you. Coming up on 48 minutes after the hour, as a tenuous ceasefire is in place in Gaza, a new regional player is stepping in, offering to mediate. Turkey says it will mediate between Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank. They hope this leads to a consensus that can make the ceasefire last. Israel declared one Saturday. They say all troops can be out by tomorrow. Hamas offered to have a week-long truce as well. The National Transportation Safety Board has recovered the flight recorders from the U.S. Airways jet that landed last week on the Hudson River. They say the recordings reveal the pilot and crew's calm reaction to the emergency. Most of the plane is now on a barge in a New Jersey marina. They're still looking for one of the engines. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai are at it again, power-sharing talks, that is. They resume today in Zimbabwe. The talks have been stalled for several months. And today marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of Edgar Allan Poe. Now, Poe actually lived in five different cities throughout his life. He was born in Boston, grew up in Richmond, and then kind of wandered among, you know, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York. And today, you know, because there's tourist dollars at stake, pretty much every city is trying to claim him. So he died and was buried in Baltimore.
He's a popular guy.
Yeah, so everybody really wants to, like, you know, pose, this is our place. But Baltimore, of course, is the only one that's named an NFL team. That's where they get the names Ravens. But obviously the tide of history didn't help on the gridiron yesterday. They lost to the Steelers, missed out on the Super Bowl. But
yes.
Maybe next time. We'll see.
Quoth the Raven.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe Los Angeles can name after a poem or something like that. We'll see. But and also, January is kind of an unusual period for movies. Hollywood kind of tends to load a lot into the end of the year. So all the Oscar bait, all of the crowd-pleasing stuff, mostly gone. Some of it's still hanging around. So that, by way of saying, that's why the number one movie in America is called Paul Blart Mall Cop. Now, I'm not a professional reviewer. I haven't seen it. But just based on the title, it tells you a lot of the cinematic art that
the Mall Cop beat Clint Eastwood. OK, that's American culture for you. We've moved on from Go Ahead, Make My Day. Thank you, Mark. So the focus on D.C. for tomorrow's inauguration, but it's a national event. What are you going to be doing in your own community? We want to hear your plans and what's happening locally. Tell us your inauguration plans at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
John, today may be the beginning of the end of Guantanamo Bay as a detention center. There is a full week of pretrial hearings scheduled for some of the remaining 245 men still in custody. However, President-elect Barack Obama reportedly intends to suspend and shut it down as one of his first acts in office. So what does that mean? For that, we talked earlier with BBC defense correspondent Rob Watson. I asked him how the detainee system will work if Barack Obama shuts Guantanamo Bay down.
Well, that's the big question. How is this going to work and how long will it take? I think it's already become clear from officials close to the incoming Obama administration that the military commissions themselves, that is the process that's sort of underway in Guantanamo, that will come to an end. But that, of course, does leave you with the problem with, okay, well, we do want to try some of these people. How are we going to do it? Are we going to do it in federal courts in the United States? Are we going to do it in some other way? And what about the other people that we don't want to try, people that we just think we're never going to secure a conviction against them? We still think they're dangerous, but we don't want to be holding on to them permanently.
That's exactly the question, right? Because out of those roughly 250 men, 20 of them have already been charged with crimes. The vast majority, though, around 230 or so, have not. So they would be treated differently, and how?
Well, I think what you're going to see is an effort by the Obama administration when it finally gets down to business to see whether some of these people, and I think the figure is about 50 to 60, who could be sent to European countries, because a lot of them, and we're talking particularly about people who are sort of Algerians, some Afghans, some Saudis, some others, who the United States, even the Bush administration, didn't think that they were going to be able to prosecute them. Mm-hmm. They thought they were dangerous. But they're people that can't go back to their own countries for fear that they will either be tortured or in other way mistreated. So an effort is underway to persuade some of the Europeans. And the Europeans have given this a lot of thought. There are some in Europe who say, yes, we want to curry favor with the Obama administration. Let's take some in. Others who think, well, United States created this problem, let them sort it out. But then, of course, you do have this other issue of, well, what about the people that you do think are serious threat and that you do want to deal with? And essentially, I suspect that what's going to happen is that some of these people will be prosecuted, probably in federal courts of some sort. Of course, the administration will need to come up with some sort of clauses as to, well, what would happen to some of these people if they weren't convicted? Are they going to be allowed to stay in the United States? Will they be kicked out of the country? What will happen? And then I think you've got this really big problem of people that are definitely considered a danger, but who it will be very hard to prosecute, partly perhaps because they've been tortured or that there isn't very good evidence. What do you do about them? And the way we think that the Obama administration is leaning is that it doesn't want to contain them, to detain them indefinitely, as the Bush administration had done. But what it is going to do with them, well, that's a tricky one.
It certainly is tricky and convoluted. But interestingly enough, let's go back to what you just said a second ago. You mentioned Algeria, and actually, obviously, this would be one of the last acts of the Bush administration. But on Saturday, the administration announced that five of the detainees had been transferred abroad. I'm not quite sure why they described it as transferred. Four of them to Iraq and one to Algeria. What do you make of that, Rob?
Well, in a way, it's part of a continuing process. Over the last few years, the United States has been trying, if you like, to thin out the population at Guantanamo by either sending them to countries that would be willing to accept them or indeed to their home countries, provided there had been some sort of guarantees that they wouldn't be mistreated. So I see that as being, if you like, the parting shot in this effort to thin down the Guantanamo.
But are they imprisoned in those countries? Or are they set free in those countries? Are they, when they say transferred, it sounds like custody was transferred from the U.S. to these other countries.
Well, different things has happened in different countries over the years. I mean, it should be said that one of the fears that the Bush administration had all along, it's got two fears, if you like. One, that some countries that you hand detainees back to will be far too tough on them, will torture them, will mistreat them, and that others will be too lenient, and that although they may give guarantees, look, don't worry, we'll keep these people under watch, or we may even consider prosecuting them ourselves, in the end, they just wander off.
Well, Rob, is there any basis in international law or even precedent in international diplomacy for a nation declaring, for whatever reason, that this group of people is too dangerous to release and then holding them relatively indefinitely? I mean, has that ever happened in the past?
Well, I guess that the closest parallel, and in a way this is where everything got so sticky in the first place, is this idea of prisoners of war. I mean, one of the alternatives that the Bush administration had at the very beginning of the war on terror, if you like, is to say, well, look, everyone we capture, there are people who've declared war on us. Osama bin Laden declared war on us in 1998. We could just detain them until the war is over. But they would have also, under those conditions, under those Geneva conventions, they would have said, well, you know, you're not allowed to question people or interrogate them. But instead, the Bush administration didn't take that route, did it? It sort of did a bit of a hybrid. It said, you know, yes, they're sort of prisoners of war, but because they weren't in uniform, they don't enjoy the usual privileges. So if you like, we're in very much uncharted water.
Does the international community take this threshold of we consider them a danger seriously, or is this something that will pass with the Bush administration?
Well, you know, I think that those people in the international community, and one is thinking of police and intelligence services, who are very, very familiar with those who are being held, I think they probably do take it seriously. You know, they will have had a lot of detail about these people, and will, like the Obama administration will be, they'll be scratching their heads as to how do you make sure you don't just release these people and they come back to do the same old thing again.
And so, largely, yeah, I mean, Rob, isn't some of that concern based on the treatment that they got at Guantanamo Bay, that perhaps some of these detainees have become radicalized after their experiences there, if perhaps they didn't even start off that way? And many countries have made the argument of why would I want to take someone that I'm concerned could cause some harm in my country?
Absolutely. If you like, there are two categories. There's those who you wouldn't want to take them because you really do know that there is a good case against them, and those that you maybe wouldn't want to take because you think, well, even if they weren't particularly violent and radical to start with, they probably are now.
Rob Watson, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Rob Watson is a BBC defense and security correspondent, and he reported to us from the BBC's Bush House in London.
So tomorrow's Inauguration Day, and we're going to be live from the streets of D.C. all over the city with our very own Femi Oke, Andrea Bernstein, and Todd Zwillick, who I think he might be close to actually sitting next to the president tomorrow. He's got a seat very, very close to the front. You can check out our Inauguration 2009 page on thetakeaway.org. We're going to have live coverage of the inauguration. There'll be slideshows of Obama's historic path to the White House and stories of people who have traveled long distances to see Obama's first day on the job. What are you going to be doing tomorrow for the inauguration?
Hi, this is Bob Brasek in New York. Considering the situations in the world today, the only thing I can really be enthusiastic about is the milestone of having our first African-American president. Other than that, I'm going to work in the shop tomorrow. I'm a cabinet maker, and I'll have the radio on all day, and I'll be cautiously optimistic, and I don't envy Mr. Obama the task he has in front of him. Good luck, Mr. Obama.
Would you rather make economic policy or cabinets? All the attention locally focused on D.C., but we want to know what's going on in your community. Here's your takeaway.
If you're an American abroad, and I have a number of friends from high school and college who are living abroad, that it's suddenly cool to be an American again.
I'm one, John Hockenberry.
Dora Udoji.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.